Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's The Wonky Show. We're talking about the final stage of the free speech bill, a new Brown review, and the AI chat robot making waves online. It's all coming up.
That's why the governance issue is so important. Who owns this and what else do they own and why? Without becoming paranoid about it, I think we should be barking on these sorts of initiatives without having a really clear understanding of it.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach. And joining me to scratch beneath the surface of higher education this week are three titans of HE policy. In London, it's Nicola Dandridge, Professor of Practice in Higher Education Policy at the University of Bristol. Nicola, your hire for the week, please.
Well, I think it was a CARA trustee meeting yesterday, which I went to. I'm a trustee of the Council for At-Risk Academics. And what it does is place academics at risk of persecution in their country of origin, mainly now Afghanistan, Ukraine, Yemen, Turkey and so on, in UK universities. And what came over so strongly yesterday was despite all the headwinds that UK universities are facing, they are still being incredibly generous in welcoming these academics into the universities. And it was very reassuring and fantastic to hear about just the extent of their generosity and support.
Lovely. And above his garage in Cambridge, it's Jonathan Grant, director at Different Angles. Jonathan, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, nice to be back, Mark. I guess not dissimilar to Nicola, my highlight of the week was a sponsoring committee event to establish a branch of Cambridge Citizens, which I attended last night. And it was just so inspiring, reaffirming to meet other people in the city, from schools, from further education colleges, from both universities, who are committed to sort of meaningful social action through the art of community organising. So it's very early days in establishing a Cambridge Citizens, but I'm very enthusiastic and excited to be involved.
Hmm. And in Manchester, it's Sunday Blake, Wonky's associate editor. Sunday, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week was attending the Knight Foundation Trustee Board, where we got to look at the year in review for the charity and see all the great work that's been done to help care experienced and estranged students.
Now, we start the week with the free speech bill, its final throes in Parliament. Jonathan, what has happened this week?
Well, last night, the higher education brackets free speech bill, close brackets to give it its full title, moved from the report stage to the third reading in the House of Lords. It's probably just worth reflecting a bit on the background to this, because the bill was first tabled back in May 2021 by a certain Gavin Williamson, now Sir Gavin Williamson, not at that time, to address perceived issues within the sector around freedom of speech. And I actually gave evidence at the committee stage in the House of Commons in September 2021. And whilst I'm overly sceptical about the bill, the need for it and what it's trying to do, I think last night there were two amendments which as a sector we should welcome quite enthusiastically. The first amendment was slightly strange because it was kind of an add-on but not unimportant, which is the banning of the use of NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, in relation to misconduct or alleged misconduct. And this is a debate which has been occurring in the sector for some time. There's been a sort of voluntary campaign to ask universities to pledge about not misusing NDAs in this way. And this amendment would actually make it unlawful to do so. And, basically, I would conclude that, this has been an unsavoury practice. quite widespread in the sector, and it's probably a good thing that we move away from that practice.
Turning to Amendment 6, tabled by the noble Lord, Lord Collins of Highbury, which seeks to prohibit providers and constituent colleges from entering into non-disclosure agreements with staff, members, students and visiting speakers in relation to complaints of sexual misconduct, abuse or harassment, or other forms of bullying or harassment. I'd like to thank the noble Lord for tabling this following the debate at committee and in the other place. And as your lordships will have seen, I have put my name to the amendment.
But probably more relevant to the whole debate around freedom of speech is the amendment tabled by former Universities Minister, now Lord David Willetts, which was to remove a clause 4. For older listeners, it seems slightly strange that we have a former Tory removing a clause 4. But the point here was that this was the clause that allowed people who felt that they had been denied their freedom to speak to actually go to court and to sue either the university and or the student union. And Willetts and many other people, I think, felt that this threat of legal action would actually in itself have a chilling effect, because nobody would be willing to take the risk on inviting in, if you like, controversial speakers.
And I think of people who try to organise events painstakingly to promote freedom of speech in their universities, trying to find a neutral chair who will chair two highly controversial and disputing views. When one person turns up, they try to arrange for the B2B an alternative, try to find the right place where these meetings can turn up. And sometimes they are already traduced in the media as if somehow they are part of the problem, when they're actually trying very decently to be part of the solution. Will the prospect of a legal challenge to what they're doing give them the confidence to carry on organising those events and promoting freedom of speech in our universities? I fear it will have the opposite effect.
It's interesting also because to a degree, the government had backed down and had moved, had tabled its own amendment where it effectively allowed the intervention, the legal intervention, to occur after all other routes that have been explored. So again, a bit of policy jargon to create a backstop. But the Lords actually passed the Willetts amendment, which meant that this clause 4 has actually been removed from the bill.
An institution guilty of violating academic freedom would have to fork out cash to an individual whose rights were infringed. And as one academic law professor, Professor Julius Grover, an associate professor at the University of Oxford, points out, that threat alone could be enough to encourage university and college leaders to promote academic freedom.
Just to finish, Mark, I think it's important to stress it's not all over. The bill goes to the third reading of the House of Lords, and then to a degree it's up to how the government will respond. You may get one of these ping pong effects where it goes between the Commons and the Lords. But I think the overall sense of the debate is that's reasonably unlikely, and it does seem that common sense has prevailed. I did have a quick look at Toby Young and the Free Speech Union's Twitter feed this morning to see how they were reacting. The Free Speech Union, for example, has a tweet out accusing Lords of being too close to university vice chancellors. But it doesn't seem to be that strong a backlash. So overall, I think quite a good night for the sector.
Wonky Show listeners have been following the twists and turns of this one since the beginning. Let's start with the clause 4, the statutory tort that's been removed now. And Nicola, I'm not going to pick on you too much. You have moved on from RFS, but surely you'd be in your old role at RFS. You'd be breathing a sigh of relief that this one has gone, because of the legal quagmire that was predicted in terms of how everyone was just going to start suing each other left, right, and centre.
Well, as you quite rightly say, Mark, I can't speak in any capacity as OFS either. Current or former, but I've always been quite clear and actually quite public about the fact I thought clause 4 was a bad idea. So I am massively relieved. And I actually thought the Lords debate on this was really interesting, because I didn't watch it. I read Hansard, and you read it through, and it's as if the government's compromise, the backstop that Jonathan was talking about, is going to go through. And then suddenly David Willetts comes in with his proposal to the amendment to abolish the whole of Clause 4. And then it goes to the vote, and it's quite a close vote, actually, 218 to 175. And the whole thing gets abolished. And it's kind of, I'm not saying House of Lords debates are ever exciting, but it's as close to exciting as it can get. And I do think this is really quite significant, because it's not just that, as Jonathan said, it would have a chilling effect. It would be an absolute recipe for litigation, and be massively expensive, and I think damaging, actually, to not just universities, but student unions too. So I think this is welcome, and I very much hope that it doesn't get reintroduced in the Commons, because actually what's left, it's not a weakened bill. I think the new powers that are created for the OFS and more widely, and the responsibilities imposed on universities are really, they achieve, I think, in broad terms, the objectives that are sought. You don't need this taught as well.
Mm. Yeah, I think without that, I mean, the strongest opposition to this bill is going to fall away substantially. I mean, there are big debates about whether it was needed in the first place, but that's kind of, you know, that's moved on. It was Clause 4, it was this legal tort that I think people were concerned about most, and I'd be surprised if there was anyone going to take on a cause of seriously objecting at this point, given the really kind of most contradictory, most problematic element has been stripped out. So moving on to the NDA question, that was a surprise because the government accepted a Labour amendment on that. And what's fascinating about this is the kind of implication that this wouldn't have happened had the sector accepted the voluntary code on this proposed by then Universities Minister Michelle Donlan. But now banning NDAs in cases of sexual harassment is looks like it's going to come into legislation. Jonathan, you said that should be welcomed by the sector. I think most people would agree with that. Sunday, what's your read of this?
Obviously, I do think it's a good thing. I think we have to be really careful, though, because obviously officially banning an NDA is great on paper. But even before this passed, institutions have sort of outwardly said that they don't use NDAs because they haven't used something called a non-disclosure agreement, but they have been found to be using like confidentiality clauses. So it's how it's going to be sort of implemented and regulated is how I'm interested to see how that pans out. I think also it's one thing having something discussed and agreed on in a House of Lords. It's another thing students knowing their rights. So in lots of cases of sexual misconduct, and even someone that I was interviewing a couple of weeks ago said, my university told me I couldn't tell anyone about this, so I didn't. And particularly that's my concern, is that there is, you know, technically there's no NDA involved there, but this is a school leaver age student who has been told by their institution that they're not allowed to tell anyone. So I think this can't just be a sort of quiet amendment. It has to go alongside a culture change in the way that we deal with sexual violence, both at an institution and a sector level. And it has to go alongside students knowing their rights around investigations, around complaints, around outcomes, as well as having trust in the institution, which I'm not seeing much of. So things like the Office for Students Prevalence Survey, I'm really interested to see where that goes, because obviously they're going to be looking at prevalence rates, and we can then compare that to report rates and work out sort of how that indicates the level of trust that students have in their institution. So yeah, it's good. It's fundamentally a really good thing, you know, to have this in black and white, but it has to go alongside a culture change as well.
Nicola, what do you think? Do you think the sector should be welcoming this? I mean, so it was Sunday and Jonathan said so for slightly different reasons, but what do you think?
Yeah, I think it is quite, I think it's a good thing. And And I doubt that the sector is going to be oppose this. Well, I mean, not that it could if it wanted to, but I think the clarification of not using these NDAs is quite a good thing. I mean, I'm rather with Sunday on this. I think the practicalities are going to be very interesting because actually the way it's drafted restricts the ban to complaints of sexual misconduct, harassment, and bullying, but not other things. And I don't quite know how that's going to work out, given that normally these sorts of complaints raise all sorts of issues, of which only some will be subject to this NDA ban. So I think I agree with Sunday that that it's going to need quite a lot of thought as to how it's implemented so that it achieves the objectives it wants. But generally, I think it's a good thing. I mean, it's about transparency, and in this area of all areas, that must be welcome.
Mm. And more work for the lawyers, probably, almost certainly.
Mark, could I just come in there? So I absolutely agree with Sunday's comments in terms of implementation. But I was this morning I was doing a quick sort of Google round to see whether other sectors, non-HE sectors, have similar sort of statutory bans of NDAs in place. And as far as I can work out, that's not the case, including the civil service, although there has been debate about that in the past. So I do think it's worth just reflecting that the HE sector may actually be leading on this and will be a bit of a guinea pig for how it plays out in terms of implementation as well.
Yes, that's a really good point. It'd be absolutely fascinating to see how this shakes out. Right, and you can read more about the free speech bill as ever in the show notes and on wonky.com. Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
The pandemic had a lasting impact on students' well-being. During lockdown, students were suffering different levels of trauma and were supported by caring teaching staff who engaged with them via digital technologies. Caring teachers recognised student trauma and worked hard to create stimulating and engaging environments for them, using digital tools to encourage active collaboration and dialogue. When lockdown ended, students studying on campus asked for a return to classroom study. We are urging universities to identify and maintain the benefits to students accrued through learning online, while also retaining benefits of face-to-face teaching. This can be achieved through a pedagogy of care. Well-designed blended learning can sustain a caring approach to teaching in ways that can support students through challenging times.
Now, Gordon Brown is back with a review of the UK Constitution for the Labour Party with quite a lot of interesting little things for higher education, as well as the broader shape of what the Labour Party wants to do if it wins the next election. Nicola, can you talk us through it?
Yes, well, this is a great political blast from Gordon Brown's Commission on Devolution and Constitutional Reform. As the name suggests, it's mainly focused on proposals for devolution and constitutional issues, deals with lots of issues, quite broadly presented, so not a lot of detail yet. And it proposes setting up a new constitutional statute, proposals on cleaning up Westminster. The issue that's cleaning up Westminster, I mean, dealing with how MPs behave. So, for example, majority of second jobs will be outlawed, things like that. And the proposal which has caught the headline most of all is reform of the House of Lords, which would be substantially reformed and slimmed down to become a democratically elected assembly of the nations and regions with oversight of the new constitutional arrangements. But also, I mean, it's very clear that it's going to carry on with its role of scrutiny of proposed legislation from the House of Commons, which is interesting in the context of the free speech discussion we've just had. You know, they will carry on playing that kind of really important role. Of relevance to higher education in particular are the proposals to devolve powers to cities and regions, particularly in relation to developing their own economic and social plans. And it's very explicit that universities are going to be partners in the development of those plans and also skills development. There's a rather odd few comments saying that universities are not involved in discussions about regional skills developments. And I thought that was slightly curious because I'm not sure that's strictly true. But anyway, whatever their role is being promoted in this agenda, and that is very welcome. On skills, very much focused on FE proposals for streamlined funding arrangements and planning, reference to the need to develop more technical skills and STEM graduate skills. And that comes in the context of a place-based R&D and innovation clusters focus, and it's support for the Strength in Places funding from UKRI and so on. Finally, reappraisal of relations with Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, emphasis on just really embedding the perspectives of the devolved nations into Westminster decision making. That's something that would be overseen by the reformed House of Lords. That's a very crude summary of some quite detailed proposals. The one thing I did pick out, though, is that the focus on regional planning and funding arrangements very much on skills, and then universities cast in their role as developing research and innovation, and nothing, it was silent on the role of universities' educative role for undergraduates, apart from that passing reference the need for more STEM graduates. So what you get, even though there's this huge focus on regional economic development and how important it is to focus on the regional and place-based perspectives, there's nothing on the role of undergraduate education in that context. And my final comment on this is that it's rather curious to be reading this and at the same time as looking at the UCAS end of cycle data that's just been published, where you see massive discrepancies in terms of participation, with some boroughs in London graduating over 60%, applicants over 60%, and in northeast and southwest right down at 31%. So there's huge regional imbalances in terms of graduate participation, but that doesn't play into the report. And I think that's a shame. But overall, I mean, it's a tremendous commitment to regional devolution with universities at heart. It's now open for consultation, and we'll have to see how much of this actually makes it through into the Labour Party's manifesto.
Fascinating stuff. Jonathan, it occurs to me that the place-based innovation-led R&D stuff presents quite a bunch of interesting opportunities for universities, even though universities aren't kind of explicitly put as the drivers of that in the work. Clearly, there's a lot of things to backfill this, but opportunities nonetheless, right?
Yeah, no, I agree. And also, I think we should realise that universities are doing this to a degree as well. I remember back in the 2014 ref looking at where impact occurs geographically, and identifying places like Huddersfield and Bradford, I think, had the highest number of impact case studies that were having a local impact. And I'm involved in repeating that analysis currently for the 2021 ref. And again, we're seeing that. So universities are having impacts in their vicinity through their research and innovation activities, as well as through their education activities and sort of being a employer or a responsible employer in their locality. So, slightly strange for a wonky show, but I think this is a very welcome intervention, if you like. And I think it's up to the universities to almost help put some of that detail on the skeleton outlined in the review, and really sort of champion what universities can do at a local level in supporting communities through all three of their missions. Be that sort of engagement, research, or education. The other thing I just reflect on, because I think the data Nicola just shared there on university participation rates by region is really interesting. And one of the things that we're looking at the moment in the REF21 data is the sort of flow of impact. And we are finding a degree of levelling up. So you do find, if you like, institutions in the southeast, the Golden Triangle, describing research that had an impact outside of the Golden Triangle. So again, when we think about some of these things, there is a sort of quite a nuance, if you like, to some of the way that the universities operate both locally, nationally, and obviously internationally.
Mm, yeah, fascinating. And it is, this is, I guess, is that we head towards the general election cycle, we're getting more and more, aren't we, a sort of sense, a mood, even some detail of what Labour's thinking and plans and ideas are. And it is It is very interesting because we've been a sort of, you know, we've been a bit of a policy glut, we've not heard much from Labour in terms of its thinking for quite some time. And, you know, this what's dominated the space has been the discussion of levelling up, which looks like it feels like it hasn't really gone anywhere in a very substantial way. This is the start of a different alternative, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. And I think the chat, you know, so it was interesting when in the, you know, the very long levelling up white paper, how few times universities were mentioned. They were mentioned, but it wasn't a dominant theme. And, you know, I think anybody in any city or any town which has a university will realise that universities are part of that partnership, local partnership, to help stimulate economic growth. I agree with Nicola. I think there's the sentiment in the Brown report is very welcome, but the devil will be in the detail. And actually, I think that's where we should get on the front foot and start to really think through what, if you like, local civic partnerships could look like, with universities acting as one of the leaders in that role, with an aim to deliver local impacts. And just as an aside on that, I do think on the research and innovation side, we do use this language of world leading and science superpower, but actually the impact, the local impact of research and innovation seems to me as important. And a lot of the incentive systems, whether that's REF, whether that's research grant funding, still focus on that world leading sort of language. And maybe we just need to reflect a bit around that as well, and support research and innovation that is designed to have a local impact as well.
Mm. Fascinating. Nicola, I had you nailed on as a peer at some point entering House of Lords. I'd be sorry if it gets reformed to the point that you don't get that opportunity. I'd love to see you in that chamber.
That is the most ridiculous suggestion, Mark, if you don't mind me saying. But can I just, I agree with what Jonathan said about world leading. It's the one bit that really grated when I read it. Because actually all the focus is on the regional role of universities, which is a totally different way of categorising them, and sort of that easy moniker of world leading, which is associated, as Jonathan said, with incentives that drive in quite the opposite direction. It just felt rather unhelpful and odd.
A lot of this was sort of music to my ears, as someone who sort of studied and lived in a relatively rural and remote part of the country. I thought, like, following on from what Nicola has said around sort of that graduate retention in London versus other areas, that has a huge impact on things like levelling up and skills retention. I find that, and again, I can only, talking from a position of in Devon and Cornwall, our graduates don't stay in the region. Now, I haven't got concrete evidence on exactly why this is, but obviously where Nicola is saying, you know, you've got 60% of graduate intake in Greater London going into the institutions, 41% of those graduates then stay in London, whereas only 30% of local graduates stay in the region in places like in Devon and Cornwall. So we tend to find that these places hemorrhage graduates into the main cities, and obviously that then has an impact on that regional development. I also think it's really interesting to look at this from a sort of WP perspective. One of the things I see Central London University's praised for a lot is their sort of outreach, local outreach and intake, and how well they're doing in terms of WP. But obviously, obviously these institutions do work very hard and do very well, but a huge part of that success is based on the fact that they are in a place with like incredible transport structures, and like the support is there from the sort of local authorities. Whereas if you come back to places like, and you know, there's extreme deprivation in London as well. So when we're looking at WP and like low income households, obviously they are sort of hitting those targets. But if you look at somewhere like Devon and Cornwall, OFS Gap Ward analysis said that 8% of the wards in Devon and Cornwall fall into the lowest 20% of young people entering higher education. And that is down to the fact that there is just absolute extreme poverty in areas of Devon and Cornwall where they haven't got the transport routes to get to the institution. So they, you know, you'll be looking at a student who is taking 4 hours worth of public transport to get onto campus. So if universities are going to be sort of centralized in this discussion around, like, the, you know, the power and the discussion and the conversation is going to be being put into the local authorities and the local regions, and universities are going to be able to be part of that conversation, I think all those sort of nuances around graduate skills, local intake, I think that those are going to become really clear and potentially contribute to better levelling up.
And now it's time for the hidden history of higher education with sector historian Mike Ratcliffe.
So Tony Crosland decides that there aren't going to be any more universities, but he decides that the expansion that he needs in higher education is going to come through a new type of institution. So Crosland makes his famous Woolwich speech. He talks about how we should have a public sector of higher education and starts to set about the process of thinking about how that might be. And that leads to a white paper on polytechnics, the idea that we should start to have a different type of institution owned by the local authorities, responsive to local needs. And Crosland says that we should have these universities shouldn't be caught up on the snobbish sense that they all had to be universities. He wants to stop them from going on and becoming universities. He wants to stay where they are. And that's underpinned by a theory that one of his advisors, Tyrrell Burgess, has of academic drift, that what happens is that a local college gets above its station effectively and develops more and more higher education, becomes a university, and then ignores its locale afterwards. So he wants to fix the polytechnics in their place. So there's another one of those great exercises where local authorities get to bid to have their institutions turn into them. The idea in this case is not a completely new institution, but to see whether or not your technical college has got enough critical mass of full-time students that it might become a polytechnic. And so there are various different bids, and that involves all the local authorities thinking how they can amalgamate their higher education into a sufficient mass. Now that means, particularly for the polytechnics, that they have to be in existing large areas, because there isn't enough critical mass out in the countryside where they've put some of the new universities. So the polytechnics are all start off being based in larger city centres, which often means that the poly turns up in a city that has already got a university, because by the time it's got there, it's had an old university, so the poly comes along. So in terms of spatial policy, it's useless, because the polys just end up in the same cities as the universities. But they get going and they pull those things together. Now, some places don't get to have their poly. So Hull really looked like it was going to be a leading contender to have its polytechnic, but it didn't come off. There was arguments, and in the end, they didn't get a polytechnic in Hull. And other people were kept waiting. There were discussions about which bits would get merged together. But the idea was to create this public sector. Now, the other clever thing they managed to do is they used the kind of scheme that they'd done with the Colleges of Advanced Technology and have a body to approve their awards. And this is the CNAA, the Council for National Academic Awards. And this innovation allows government off the hook of giving degree awarding powers out to all these different institutions and allowing them to say, well, look, we're just going to have this one body that would approve them. And the masterstroke for the CNAA is that they don't go for the London model of setting the exams and making the students do it. They allow the courses to develop with the institutions. The institution can bring much more of its local flavour. There's a coordinating sense, so that, you know, a degree in business is broadly similar across the UK, but actually you start to get quite a lot of local variations. And that includes some of the really innovative things, the negotiated pathways leading to degrees in independent studies, and you get quite a lot of distinctiveness that comes out. And it develops quite a good corpus in terms of, you know, understanding how courses work, develops quite a lot of good practice, and the concepts that really underpin the CNAA tradition underpin quite a lot of what then becomes part of HEQC and QAA. The idea that it would be quite a good idea to think about a course before you started it, quite a good idea to have quite a lot of transparency about the information. In time, it becomes a vehicle for considering that modules might be a good way of organising them. But none of that's set down at the start, but you start to get much more of a kind of development of a homogeneity of how you might organise courses, which puts the UK on a pretty good setting. So the polytechnics head off in that direction. They survive the change of government in 1972. Now, there's a good chance that when the Conservatives took over, they could have killed off two things. They could have killed off the Open University, and they could have killed off the polytechnics. But Margaret Thatcher likes the polytechnics. The polytechnics are kind of business orientated. They're trying to develop skills. They're quite up for offering expansion and not complaining about it too much. And there's a great, again, on the file of the National Archives, an example where leaders of higher education were invited along to meet the Prime Minister. And they're invited to dinner at number 10. And there's a great briefing note that explains to Ted Heath exactly what status these people are. So there's these lovely little vignettes against each of the vice chancellors, saying which ones are clever and which ones know what they're doing, which ones look a bit bumbling but actually quite bright underneath it. So there's that kind of stuff, the kind of stuff that you probably get given now when you go to these kind of things. But there's a general summation of the two camps. Vice chancellors are concerned about the role and standing of universities. They suspect that the government underprice them and do not consider them relevant enough. Whereas, on the other side of the binary line, the polytechnics are generally in good heart. They have their preoccupations. Chief amongst them is the need for greater clarification of their role, particularly in relationship to the local authorities, and the massive expansion, trebling, of student numbers following the white papers. So the polytechnics have gone in to see Ted Heath, saying, yep, we will treble our numbers, we will go for expansion, and they will pull that off. So that kind of sense of the Conservatives can look to polytechnics to be the kind of organisation to come on and develop them is something that underpins Margaret Thatcher's time as Secretary of State for Education right at the beginning of the 70s.
Ready to pop the question? The jewellers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, it dropped like a bomb over last week, the ChatGPT software and from OpenAI. With a bunch of implications for universities, students, and, well, really, you know, all of humanity. Sunday, talk us through it.
Yes. Okay. This is an AI chat box, and there has been concern around how this will be used in universities, particularly among students, and the impact that it's going to have on the traditional learning experience. So some people are arguing that the advanced language processing abilities of ChatGPT can enhance an educational process by personalising feedbacks and suggestions to students on their writing via AI. However, others are worried that a reliance on technology could lead to a decline in critical thinking skills and a lack of creativity in problem solving. This week also saw the results of JISC's Teaching Staff Digital Experience Insight Survey, and the highlights were that less than a third of staff actually agree that online teaching allows them to teach in their preferred method, and similarly, less than a third thinks that they can conduct assessment fairly using digital teaching platforms. And agreement among staff that online teaching enables students to make good progress was also very low at 30%. Of the respondents, and there were around 3,500 from 30 different organisations, they did agree that online teaching was convenient for them, with around 90% of surveyed participants conducting at least some of their teaching from home.
I am equally unbelievably excited and astonished by ChatGPT and similar, and terrified by it. And I mean, terrified because it's so incredibly powerful, and also worth bearing in mind, it's a Elon Musk initiative originally. So I had a go with it, and I asked it a sort of fairly innocent question about what the point of going to university is if you could study courses online for free. And it came back with the most incredibly thoughtful answer. I mean, really good, actually, about the fact that going to university is worth much more than just studying. And, you know, an answer that really was, I thought, worthy of a UK press release. And then I sort of pressed it a bit, saying, well, what is your opinion about X, Y, and Z? And it just wouldn't budge on that. It said, I am not programmed to give opinions. And I tried to have a debate with it, saying, but are you saying that the very sophisticated information that you're putting out is not, hasn't got values embedded in it? And it just wouldn't, it wouldn't accept that. It just said, no, I'm completely objective. And I mean, that's where it starts getting rather scary, because it sort of implies that this is objective knowledge, but I mean, it is programmed and it's taking its information from the internet, and I think, and oh, by the way, incidentally, I also asked it what the meaning of life was, just to see what it came up with, and it was absolutely useless on that too. It just said different people have different views. But look, coming back to HE, so I'm still searching for the meaning of life. But going back to HE, I mean, the positive is that this could be an incredibly useful learning resource if used properly. And I was also, you know, putting in some more sensible things, asking it for its views on English literature, actually. And it's really, you know, it can be really, really useful. But I think the challenge is how it gets used. And how can you control its content when it's basically a for-profit organisation, as far as I understand it?
Jonathan, it raises a bunch of questions, doesn't it, on things like assessment. On the one hand, you could see how it could speed up assessment. On the other hand, you could also see how it can create new forms of cheating.
Yeah, so I tried to log on to it, but it wouldn't accept me for whatever reason, so I didn't get to play with it, which I'd love to have done. But I think with all of these technologies, there's always upsides and downsides, and I guess the challenge is to mitigate the downsides and manage the upsides. But from what I read about it and from what Nicholas just said, it is an extraordinary bit of technology. And one that we should embrace, because frankly, it's not going to go away. So the question is, how does it change practice in the future, potentially? And as Nicola just highlighted, what are the ethical dimensions, i.e. this is potentially a for-profit tool, but I assume others would come on the market in the future. In terms of assessment,
I think that they have put it out for free to get feedback and to help it develop. And it's
but they put it out for free to get feedback because their feedback strengthens their algorithms that then they can market in the future. Which is quite classic model for AI stuff, as far as I can tell. But I do think. So on the assessment question, I think the question is not how this affects assessment, but it's the broader question is how should we effectively assess in the future in the context of the digital age? And now that's a debate that's been going on for a long, long time. So I just think this is another layer into that debate. And what is the most appropriate way to assess in the 21st century is probably not the same as the appropriate way in the 20th century. I don't have the answers to that, but I don't think we should get too hung up on that particular question. The other thing, just as a slight aside, Mark, is in the research arena, you're seeing some incredible applications of AI. So DeepMind, which is part of Google, I've been doing a wee bit of work with them. They have this thing called AlphaFold, which predicts protein structures. And that has transformed structural biology in a way that, you know, 5 years ago, you probably wouldn't have envisaged, and, you know, potentially speeded up pipelines from, you know, sort of lab to drug development and such like. So all of this is out there, it's happening, and some of it's extraordinary. And I think the question is, how do we adapt to use these technologies in an ethical and fair way?
Yeah, it felt. I mean, for me, I think you're absolutely right. The debates are not new. I think what was startling about this week is just I think the technology has just moved on in a way that's so much more advanced than I think a lot of people realized, and you know, most of this, you know, a lot of this tech has only been, you know, been in the hands of researchers and things for a few years, and I think, you know, because a lot of the public AI stuff is kind of, you know, a bit naff a lot of the time, so this, I don't know, it was just a bit of a kind of oh my god moment when you could start seeing what it could what it could do.
It couldn't answer the meaning of life question, though, could it?
No, but you could ask it. You could ask it what someone might, with certain beliefs, might think the meaning of life is, or those sorts of things, which is, you know, it's super interesting. I'm thinking of doing one of next week's Wonky Dailies, all generated by ChatGPT. See if anyone notices.
Yes.
The sad thing, because it's not connected to the internet, which is really sad, because if it was, then, you know, we might actually be able to do that. They've not connected it to the internet, in, at least publicly, I guess, for those ethical reasons, because you could then start, you know, putting out quite a lot of misinformation and all sorts of other ethical things get thrown up. But I mean, given that it's possible, you know, that looks like where everything is heading, doesn't it?
That's why the governance issue is so important. Mm. You know, who owns this and what else do they own and why? I mean, without becoming paranoid about it, I think we should be, barking on these sorts of initiatives without having a really clear understanding of those sorts of arrangements. And Jonathan says the ethical implications really fundamental.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discuss today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Acast, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscription services. So thank you very much to Nicola, Jonathan, Sunday, and everyone at Team Wonky that helps make it happen behind the scenes. Until next week, stay wonky.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.